here with us for the morning show as we discuss pronouns. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. You might have seen this. Merriam-Webster added a new definition of the word they to its dictionary last year. It was the word of the year. And so the reaction, they, went mainstream, even though non-binary people who don't identify as male or female have been using they and them for years. And so grammar sticklers furrowed eyebrows over incorrect English. Some commentators said this was political correctness to refer to a single person whose gender identity is non-binary. Are you someone who identifies with the pronoun they or them or a different pronoun that isn't he or she? Why do you feel this portrays your identity? How would you like English to evolve? We're at 800-642-1234. Dennis Barron is a professor emeritus of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois. His new book, and he, by the way, identifies as he, him, his on the cover of his book. It's called What's Your Pronoun Beyond He and She? Dennis, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. It's great to be here.
So before we get deep into pronouns, let's acknowledge that grammarians will likely relish this conversation, but there's a lot of terminology and parts of speech going forward here. So let's establish some working definitions of things we'll hear a lot. How do you use the terms gender neutral and non-binary in relation to pronouns?
Okay, so what we have in English is a set of pronouns for the third person singular. That's when you're just talking about one person. And they are the only pronouns in our whole pronoun system that express some idea of biological gender. We have he, she, and the neuter pronoun, it. Now, for a couple of hundred years at least, commentators about English have been noticing that there is no pronoun in that group of pronouns that accommodates situations where you either don't know the gender of the person you're talking about. Remember, we use these pronouns to talk about somebody else. We don't use them to your face. We don't use them to talk about us. We use them to refer to somebody in the third person, somebody who may or may not be present. So there's no pronoun. If you don't know the gender, what do? If you feel like mentioning gender is irrelevant and it's somehow going to distract people from your real message, there's no pronoun to use that is just neutral as far as gender goes. And what if you want to hide the gender of the person you're talking about? Let's say you're talking about a whistleblower, and you think that if you mention a gender, that may lead their enemies to more easily expose them, figure out who they are. So for protection, for if you want to keep up some suspense, let's say you're a mystery writer and you don't want to reveal who the potential perpetrator lurking in the darkness, ready to push somebody down the stairwell. You don't want to identify the gender because that will make it too easy to figure out who done it. So there's a missing word. Okay. Add to that the fact that in the last 10, 15, 20 years, our sort of public conversations have been increasingly about people who don't fit on the binary gender scale, that traditional male versus female set of two. People who feel they are non-binary, who are trans, who are somehow gender non-conforming.
They just don't fit into our system that has been there for a very long time.
Yeah. So the pronoun they sort of fills the bill. People have been using it for indefinite references, gender neutral references, since the 14th century. In the last 20, 30 years, perhaps we've started to use it for people who are non-binary, who are neither male or female, or who have transitioned from one to the other, who just aren't comfortable declaring a gender. And so that's the new meaning of singular they that the dictionaries have started to record. That's what Merriam-Webster has added to its definition of they. That's what the Oxford English Dictionary added to its definition of they. Now, there's one other option besides singular they for a gender neutral or a non-binary pronoun, and that's to coin a pronoun, to make up a new word. And for the past 200 years or more, people have been doing that as well. They say, well, okay, you think singular they is non-grammatical because you've got a plural pronoun and a singular referent? Okay, let's make up a word.
And you have been tracing so many of these coined words over, you know, hundreds of years. We're talking with Dennis Barron. He is a professor emeritus of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois. His new book is called What's Your Pronoun Beyond He and She? Are you someone who identifies with the pronoun they or them? Why do you feel this portrays your identity? How do you tell people about your preferred pronouns? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dennis, the first line of your book, when you say pronouns are sexy, you must have had a smile on your face when you saw the culmination of your decades-long research, because pronouns have become such a conversation piece in our world today.
Exactly. When in recent memory has a part of speech become the subject of dinner table conversation, become the subject of almost daily articles in the news media, conversations like this? Who talks about grammar outside of English class?
We do on public radio.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, but it's something people typically want to say, well, I did that in sixth grade. I don't want to revisit that. You know, I'm a grown-up now. But all of a sudden, it's like pronouns have become the focus in the culture wars. Pronouns have become a matter of interest on college campuses, in high schools, in businesses. Businesses have discovered that you know, accepting people's pronouns is good for the bottom line. You can make money doing this.
I want to stop you at culture wars, because pronouns have become a very political issue. Some people see it as political correctness that is going too far. What are you seeing there?
Well, I see in terms of a kind of general move toward acceptance of all kinds of stuff that used to be not very accepted. You've got a population in the U.S. that, according to surveys, is reasonably positive toward gay marriage and same-sex marriage. And so attitudes toward gender and gender nonconformity are becoming overall more inclusive, and so pronouns are playing a role in this process. And some people don't like it. People who are more traditional, who feel that gender is a binary and can't be mucked around with, say no, this is too extreme. Some people say, well, if I have to use your pronouns, you're violating my free speech rights. Is that the case, or is it the case that we're trying to be non-discriminatory, we're trying to be inclusive, we're trying to make people feel like they are part of the conversation?
We have to pause right there with our guy, Dennis Barron. His new book is called What's Your Pronoun? You can join in, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with linguist Dennis Barron here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're on a tour through the history of pronouns. We're going to trace the rise and fall, the resurgence of gender neutral and non-binary pronouns. Merriam-Webster said about the use of they that regardless of what detractors say, nearly everyone uses the singular they in casual conversation and often in formal writing. And they has been used for centuries, 1300s, Middle English, it's there. Author Dennis Barron points out that critics of singular they love to think of contexts when it can be awkward, but awkward happens to any pronoun, any word for that matter. How have pronouns evolved at your school or at your work? Do you put your pronouns in your email signature? What confuses you about pronouns in the English language? Join in, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Linguist Dennis Barron has written several books on language policy and reform. His new one is called What's Your Pronoun? And he stays with us. Dennis, you say that gender-neutral pronouns are nothing new, and you have studied the history of finding pronouns through the ages. What is notable about some of the authors you found and how they have used pronouns?
Well, some very standard traditional authors, Shakespeare, Milton, Jane Austen, Virginia Woolf, all use singular they, unselfconsciously, naturally. It's an idiom that we use when we have an indefinite reference. Everybody forgets their passwords. You use singular they. It's been going on in terms of the written record. It's been tracked back to about 1375. You can't get back too much earlier than that because in the older forms of English, there were no, they didn't even exist. They was a borrowed pronoun. It was borrowed from Old Norse by the speakers of late Old English. And it was borrowed from a group of people who spoke a language a little bit different from Old English, related to it. There were a lot of words that they had in common, but who were invading England at the time and who were basically conquering the English. So English borrowing a word from a group that was technically their enemy suggests that there was a powerful need for such a word. And that's because the Old English pronouns were all very ambiguous. The third person pronouns, hey, hail, and hit, all began to sound alike. And it was too easy to confuse them. And so this PH pronoun that gives us they, them, and their in modern English seemed like a good candidate to substitute.
So they were kind of our precursors, if you will, our ancestors of what we are today with pronouns.
Right. We take what's useful in language and we use it. That's how language evolves. If you see something hear something or see something that somebody else has said or written, and consciously or unconsciously you pick it up or you reject it. A lot of innovations, like a lot of, you know, biological mutations, go nowhere. But a lot of innovations do get spread to a wider and wider and wider group until they become so standard that we forget that their origin was very questionable.
Notable too, that we may never know all of the coined pronouns through time because some just disappear and we had no idea that they were there.
Sure. The pronoun coiners themselves tended to be mostly ordinary people. Some of them were, let's face it, crackpots. You know, hey, I've got a better idea. There's this guy in the late 18th century who said, you know what? English has two genders. It should have 13 genders.
That wouldn't be confusing at all.
No, that wouldn't be confusing at all. And he listed them. He said, well, here. Fortunately, he didn't make up pronouns to fit all those genders. But his work was received with, let's say, a certain lack of enthusiasm. This guy must be nuts, people said. They were probably a little more polite than that, but it went nowhere. Some word coiners were writers, well-educated, serious people who said, there's a missing word, maybe I can fix that. And they tended to all work in a vacuum. A lot of them were completely unaware that other people were thinking about this problem too and had come up with other words. So what we get is pronouns like heesh, himmer, and hiser, which get invented over and over again because people say, well, if you want a neutral pronoun, take the masculine pronoun, take the feminine pronoun, smush them together into some kind of compound, and there you go.
We're talking with linguist Dennis Barron. He has created a collection of more than 200 coined pronouns, a pronoun depository, if you will. His new book is called What's Your Pronoun? You can join in. What intrigues you about pronouns? What questions do you have about pronouns you've heard, you've come across, and you don't know what they mean? Join in, ask away, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dennis, you mentioned the word transgender didn't exist in the early 1900s, but gender dysphoria did. So without a word and the terminology to explain what a person was going through, how did transgender people explain what was happening or be able to, you know, was this something they just didn't talk about?
You start seeing it talked about. I'm no expert on gender history. And so what I have noticed, though, is starting around the 1990s, when you have you start seeing publications of fiction and nonfiction by people who are transgender. And one of the things you notice in some of the early writing is that they're saying, essentially, you don't have a word for me. And not that they necessarily go about developing a vocabulary, but that vocabulary did arise as people became more aware of the situation. So the need for a vocabulary in the public discourse sparked the creation of words like gender dysphoria, words like transgender, which didn't really exist before.
How has the LGBT community, in your view, increased awareness of non-binary genders?
Well, I think you start seeing this on the internet, in the early days of the internet, because what you have in the development of different styles of chat group online is people developing vocabularies for their particular chat groups. And it's not just gender chat. You see the development starting in the 1980s of online vocabulary that seems to be, you know, triggered by the particular interests of everyone who is in the chat group. They start making lists of do's and don'ts, and one of them includes, here's how we're going to define certain terms in our discussion. But you start seeing the use of pronouns, particularly invented or coined pronouns, in these chat groups that have to do with gender issues.
You've spent a lot of time on college campuses, and there's been this recent movement with What's Your Pronoun on campuses around the country, one at Harvard in 2015, another at the University of Minnesota. What are these movements like on college campuses?
Well, I think one of the earliest ones, I think, was at the University of Vermont around 2009, where students, where administrators start asking people what their pronouns are, start to allow people to, or give them the opportunity to indicate their pronouns on official documents, as well as a discussion within different groups of sort of pronoun awareness as part of the larger issue of gender diversity awareness. And so colleges have been in the forefront. When Harvard gave students the option of indicating a pronoun on their registration materials that made national news. And there was both a groundswell of support and an outcry against it, saying, what's going on these, you know, pinko lefty college campuses that we are all so scared about?
Dennis Barron is our guide as we explore the intersection of gender expression and pronouns. He's a professor emeritus of linguistics at the University of Illinois. New book, it's called What's Your Pronoun? Do you think pronouns are getting too much attention? What issues do you see with pronouns evolving? Do they restrict speech? Have you heard a pronoun that stumped you recently? What was it? Join in any point here, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation on pronouns, maybe hear from you after this news update on the Ideas Network. So right now we're talking about pronouns and what gaps they fill in the English language, what still is yet to be filled. People have been on a word quest for gender-neutral pronouns for centuries, and Merriam-Webster chose they as its word of the year last year based on the number of dictionary lookups. Do you have your pronouns in your work email signature? If so, why? If not, where do you find yourself talking about pronouns? Do you have a child with pronoun preferences? How do you talk with them about that? We're at 800-642-1234. Join in any point through the hour. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dennis Barron's new book is called What's Your Pronoun? Beyond He and She. And he, that's his pronoun, stays with us. So, Dennis, I moved to Wisconsin from Louisiana, where y'all is a very handy word. In the South, you say y'all, or if it's plural, you say all y'alls, which is very handy as well. So how have we seen the evolution of words going from, you know, singular into kind of plural, and maybe it is plural, but maybe not, and just much more loose?
Absolutely. The people tend to think that pronouns are stable, fixed, and there aren't a lot of pronouns compared to nouns. There aren't a lot of pronouns compared to verbs. It's a small class of words, but it does change. And all of our personal pronouns have singular, plural issues. So let's take the first person. I is singular, we is plural. But what about this? Today we're going to look at, you know, what we call the editorial we is usually, you know, a single first-person singular speaker who's projecting themselves into the plural as a way of including the audience. We have the royal we, which is the single monarch, the ruler, the absolute monarch, who speaks as we, as a kind of, you know, embodiment of the state, of the government, of some kind of power that's bigger than one person alone. But nobody says, hey, that's a plural pronoun being used for a singular person. They may say the emperor has no clothes or something like that, criticizing their policy, but they don't focus on the pronoun. So let's move to the second person. We have you, which, as you noted, has an emphatic plural or a non-ambiguous plural, y'all, or in other parts of the country, because y'all tends to be southern. You have in the Midwest, maybe you've encountered it in Wisconsin, yins. Or Ewins. You certainly get that in central Illinois and, you know, all the way east to Pennsylvania. And you've got the what tends to be characterized as the urban use or use guys.
Use guys,
hey, what do you want to do? I mean, that's the kind of thing that kids would say to each other when I was growing up in New York City. Hey, what do you want to do? You know, should we play stickball? Should we go hang out in the schoolyard? You know, stuff like that. Why do we do that? Because you, since the 17th century, has doubling as both singular and plural, and that can create an ambiguity. Are you talking to me one person? Are you talking to us, you know, a group? And so we try to, at least in informal and spoken English, make it clear. I'm talking to all of you. I'm talking to you ones. I'm talking to you with an S plural, use.
Giving it a little more direction and when it's trying to multitask.
Exactly. We call it technically disambiguation. So what it means is it basically tells who you're talking to, tells your audience something more specific about the scope of the pronoun, whether it's one person or multiple people. In fact, English used to have a dual. They used to have a form of the first and second person that just referred to two people. So instead of I and we, there would be an intermediate form that would be the two of us. Instead of you singular and you plural, there would be an intermediate form that and you two over there, not the other members of the group. So that disappeared. Obviously, we didn't need it enough to keep it in the language. And in the cases where we want to clarify that we're just talking about two people in a group, we walk around it. We say, you two, the two of you over there, or the two of us will go and the rest of us will not.
Let's take a moment here and talk about the pronoun he, because in the past it's been used as a generic pronoun for a person in English, but it's very conflicted. What is up with he?
Okay, so starting at the beginning of English grammars, and these are books about the language, which start to appear in the 17th century. Before that, grammar meant Latin. English was not thought of as a language important enough to have a grammar book written about it. You know, it was just there. But as English became started to become an important language in terms of world politics and world trade, people started paying more attention to the language itself. And one of the things they did was, in Latin, they borrowed a lot of Latin terminology because most of the grammars that they were familiar with were grammars of Latin, or if they were, you know, hyper-educated, maybe some classical Greek as well. In Latin, their nouns all have gender, and adjectives have to agree with the nouns in gender. This is not the case in English. But all kinds of rules were developed for Latin grammar of what to do when you have an adjective that agrees with two nouns that are of different genders.
Okay.
And so the practice was to take one of the genders, and it happened to be the masculine, and make that the sort of generic, the universal gender when that you use when you're talking about two nouns of two different genders. And this rule became known as the doctrine of the hierarchy of the genders. And the masculine was at the top, the feminine was in the middle, and the neuter was at the bottom. But English doesn't have that. And so the only place it occurs is in this pronoun system with the third person pronouns, he, she, and it. And so English grammarians said, well, okay, let's what happens when you have a noun like everybody that is not gender specific? What pronoun should you use? Should you use one? Should you use it? Should you use they? Should you use something else? And they said, hey, we've got this handy Latin rule. Let's just apply it to the English pronouns. And that's where we get the generic he from.
Right.
The problem with that is that in too many cases, he did not include women. It meant only men.
Right. And we're going to pause here just a moment with linguist Dennis Barron, who is with us. His new book is called What's Your Pronoun Beyond He and She? And you can join in. Are you a teacher? How have pronouns evolved in schools? Do you see more students using they or them? Do you have a transgender student? Are other students following their preferred pronoun? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now. Tom is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
My Uncle Jack was a priest down in New Orleans, and they'd come in, they say, when they hear confession, they say, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." But my question is this. In English, we put the pronoun before the word, the small green little thing, and then we say the word. In Spanish, they do it backwards. They have the word, and then they put the descriptive thing afterwards. And my question is, why do they do that, and how does that affect your brain? I think how you speak affects your brain.
Tom, thanks so much. Dennis, how is that treated in Spanish and other languages?
Okay, so what we're talking about here is adjectives and nouns, and the adjective in English tends to go before the noun. Most of them go before the noun, and in other languages, the practice is to put the adjective after the noun. Does that mean people have completely different brain structures? Probably not. It just means that there are two ways of doing things in language, and language tends to always have multiple ways of doing stuff. There's not just one way of doing it. Otherwise, we would only need one language, but we have, several thousand in the world, and each one does things a little differently, but they pattern with adjectives before or after the noun. Those tend to be the two major patterns of adjective placement. Other languages do have pronoun issues, okay, but they have more issues with the gender of nouns. So the discussion about gender in a language like French or Spanish or German tends to have been what happens when you have a gendered noun like doctor or lawyer or professor, and that implies one gender is doing it, and you have somebody from another gender who's also a doctor or lawyer or professor? Do you need a different word for it?
Let's pause right there. Linguist Dennis Barron as our guide as we go through the world of pronouns with you as well. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking about gender-neutral pronouns, the history. What we've learned so far is that, you know what? There's no right answer to what's your pronoun. Linguist Dennis Barron has grappled with this question for decades, and he writes, English speakers will go on living with multiple answers to the pronoun question. So at this point, if we're looking for closure, there really isn't one, because language is living. It changes as we change. You still, time for you, 800-642-1234. And Dennis Barron's new book is called What's Your Pronoun? Let's go to Sarah now, joining us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Super interested in the gender thing in terms of nouns. I can't tell you how. I'm a teacher, but my students don't worry about they because they're immigrants and they're just learning the language. But I am really curious about what you said, where English has never had gendered nouns. And it just seems like with the influence of French and German on the English language, I I mean, we must have had gendered nouns at some point, unless everybody was just speaking pre-Saxon English, which goes back so far. So I just wonder when, like, how you can say that there was never any gendered nouns, and if there weren't, could you explain some more? And did they go away at some point, and why?
Right. English used to have gendered nouns in Old English, and what happened was a gradual shift away from, in the spoken language, away from pronouncing the endings of words. And when we stopped stressing the endings of words in English, that's where the gender of the nouns, the part of the word that indicated gender, tended to be, and we sort of lost that category. German, which is a related language, as are the Scandinavian languages, Norwegian and Swedish and Danish, preserve gender in their noun systems. So English was a loner in that regard. Having lost gender in nouns, except for the nouns that actually refer to human gender roles, like actor, actress, or governor, governess, the ones that gender is indicated by a suffix, the ESS or the ETTE, or in older forms of English, the STER suffix. So a baker was the masculine term for somebody who put things in an oven, and the feminine term was a baxter.
Hmm. Wow.
Okay. So we lost that, except for the nouns that refer to actual biological gender. So in English, it doesn't matter whether a table is masculine or feminine. It was just, and it had nothing to do with biology. In French, the fact that a table is feminine has nothing to do with the biological view of French culture that tables are feminine. It simply tells you a little bit about the word's history and how it's different from other words.
Dennis Barron, I have to jump in here because we're running short on time. And I just am wondering, you know, for someone who's studied pronouns for decades, you can't look into a crystal ball because our language is evolving. You can't predict the future. But where do you take this from here in terms of how you study our language with pronouns?
Okay, so we can't predict the future, but we certainly always want to try. My guess is that for the immediate future, anyway, we're going to have a variety of ways of referring to or masking gender in the third person singular. We're going to have the traditional he and she, which are not going away. We're going to have singular they, and we're going to have a group of people who are committed to one or another of the invented pronouns, the z, here, he, she, e, per. There are a whole bunch of them that are being used. It's maybe 5% of people are using them. Maybe it's a smaller number. The figures aren't very exact. At some point, if gender stops being an issue, the pronoun system will evolve to reflect the fact that we don't care about it anymore.
Dennis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you,
Dennis,
for having me.
Dennis Barron is author of What's Your Pronoun? Beyond He and She. He's professor emeritus of English and linguistics at the University of Illinois. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg exploring the history of socialism in the Upper Midwest.
Wisconsin has a rich history in politics that has influenced many of the nation's major political movements. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look at Wisconsin's connection to socialism.
I grew up hearing how dangerous socialists were. After all, the Cold War against the USSR could turn hot if we didn't root out the communists in our midst, as Joe McCarthy warned. Then, I lived in a socialist Norway, and my wife gave birth to our first baby there. Norwegian healthcare covered the birth and gave us $5,000 to help raise the baby, and would deposit $150 into our bank account every month until our son was 18. This democratic socialist government paid for my year of college in Trondheim, paid our health care, and would pay our pension if we had stayed. These socialists certainly didn't seem so dicey after all. They seemed positively civil. Some American politicians invoke Scandinavian socialism as a model for the U.S., but I suggest we look to Wisconsin. Our state has a long history of alternatives to for-profit corporations in the form of owner-operated cooperatives and profit-sharing credit unions. Milwaukee even elected three socialist mayors. German visionaries in Milwaukee dreamed of a cooperative commonwealth rather than cutthroat capitalism and succeeded in electing socialist mayors that served most of the period between 1910 and 1960. Milwaukee's socialist mayor, Emil Seidel, even lured Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Carl Sandburg to work for him. Wisconsin may have had its share of socialist mayors, but the most influential progressive was likely Thorstein Veblen, born in Cato, Wisconsin, as the son of Norwegian immigrants. He viciously criticized cutthroat American capitalism with his famous warnings of conspicuous consumption. And his book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, became the impetus for the Roosevelt Revitalization Package for the U.S., better known as the socialist-leaning New Deal. Baptist minister Lars Jorgensen Hauge witnessed a poor Danish-American woman break down in tears after she was given just 5 cents a pound for her sweet cream butter, and then only in trade at the company store. Hauge remembered the cooperative creameries back in Denmark. So he traveled the Midwest preaching his butter sermons, pushing the farmers to share their wealth with each other by forming cooperatives. The cooperative ideal spread throughout the Midwest and expanded to general stores, food markets, gas and electrical operations, agricultural elevators, and banks as credit unions. These co-ops offer an alternative system that allows all members to have a stake in the greater good rather than working just for the wealthy. Even Midwestern houses, cozy bungalows, came from the populist arts and crafts movement that took its socialist views and applied them to handcrafted houses that were affordable to everyone. Danish landscape architect Jens Jensen brought his progressive ideals to Wisconsin. He died in Ellison Bay when he worked with Frank Lloyd Wright. Gustav Stickley from Osceola, Wisconsin, expanded on the style with his Craftsman magazine that promoted arts and crafts design and socialist equality. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote in 2010 that the socialists delivered, and the public came to expect administrations rooted in honesty, efficiency, frugality, and concern for the working person. They called their fellow citizens to a higher conception of the common good, one that placed cooperation above bare self-interest. This socialist legacy survives here in the upper Midwest with by far the most co-ops of any other area of the country. Apparently, the democratic socialism that we experienced in Norway was here all along.
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.